kind of amazes me you even suggest that, especially on a subject like homosexuality, that the propensity toward gay and lesbian behavior is a decision, actually a chosen behavior nowadays. How long ago was it that it wasn't even a notion in anyone's mind that it might be something genetic? And now it seems to be assumed, especially by the advocates of the gay and lesbian lifestyle. There's a bit of a controversy raging, if you've seen it in the paper. We're going to be talking about this controversy surrounding an upcoming gay recovery conference here in St. Louis. How dare they suggest that homosexual behavior is anything except, well, inborn and genetic? But is there proof for such a case? And what is this controversy really all about? Alan Chambers will join us here in the first 25 minutes of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. That's what's going to happen for the first half hour of the program. In the second half hour, what are we going to get to? Oh, Dr. Terry Mortensen is going to be our guest. Now, very interesting. More hoopla this year over the 197th birthday of Charles Darwin. We're going to talk a bit about some of the events that were held yesterday in honor of Darwin's birth or birthday. Dr. Terry Mortensen will be our guest from Answers in Genesis. Then, from 4 until 5 on the program, all through the second hour, Dr. D. James Kennedy preached this Sunday from his pulpit at Coral Ridge on television as well. What did he preach on? Abraham Lincoln. Was Abraham Lincoln a Christian? That's the title of his sermon. We'll be doing our sermon review this Monday on Issues Etc. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. And then fast upon a very interesting hour, couple hours last night with Dr. Uwe Simonetto on our nationally syndicated Sunday night program. Uwe joins us again this afternoon to continue our series on lay vocation. We're going to talk about science, especially intelligent design. And then in the last half hour of the program, our good friend Wesley Smith is going to warm up for next Sunday's program, where he'll be with us in our remote out in the Bay Area of California. We're going to talk about Missouri Senator Jim Talent's position on stem cell research. Is he backing down from a total ban on human cloning? What's his position now? And is this a good move, a bad move, smart, not so smart? Wesley will join us from the Discovery Institute in the last half hour of Issues Etc. today. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Now, before we get started, last night, everything went off without a hitch, at least without a hitch on the air, on our first remote for our nationally syndicated Sunday night program that we did just a couple hundred yards from here, but I failed to thank a few people, one of them sitting across the board from me, and that's Craig. Thank you very much, Craig, for your help last night. He came in and screened phones for us and helped out here in the studio, along with Dave Miller, who was running the boards as usual. Jeff did a great job, and everyone else who helped arrange it. Thanks to everyone, to Joe and to Joni for being our host and our, well, I should say our hostess and our host. Did I get them in the right order? I'm not sure. Alan Chambers is our guest for the first half hour. We're going to talk about this controversy surrounding an upcoming gay recovery conference here in St. Louis. Upcoming conference on helping gays, quote unquote, recover draws criticism, reads the headline in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Alan Chambers joins us, president of Exodus International based in Orlando, Florida. Alan, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
Are you surprised by the controversy for this upcoming conference here in St. Louis on recovering from the homosexual lifestyle?
You know, I'm not surprised. It really follows us wherever we go. We talk about issues that are controversial, and I think the mere mention that people can overcome homosexuality infuriates some and piques interest of others. And so wherever we go, we have people who are interested in what we're having to say.
So what's the real point of contention here that is causing the controversy, not only here in St. Louis, but wherever the question of gay recovery is raised?
You know, honestly, I think the point of contention is that people don't want there to be more than one side to the story. People want you to believe that homosexuality just is. You can't do anything about it. But the real truth is that hundreds of thousands of men and women like me have found freedom from homosexuality, and that's good news that we share all around the country and all around the world.
The argument that's being made, that is being made here in St. Louis, is that homosexual behavior is inborn. Perhaps there's even an explicit genetic explanation for it. And to suggest something else casts a dark shadow over those who are simply who they are. This is how God made them. How do you respond to this?
You know, for more than 50 years, people have been trying to prove that homosexuality is genetic or biological, or that you can't do anything about it. And you know, all of the studies that have been done have failed to be replicated. In fact, even the gay researchers themselves who have done these studies have come back and said homosexuality has more to do with developmental issues than it does with genetics. And the truth is, whether it's genetic or not, people like me are sufficient proof that you don't have to live under the tyranny of genetics. Change is possible. If it's genetic, my story is more than enough proof that people can overcome homosexuality regardless of what they may or may not be born into.
So Exodus International is not going to argue whether or not it's genetic. Really, I mean, that's not going to be the, without further evidence, that's not really going to be the point of the argument.
Absolutely not. Genetics really isn't the point. The truth is, we're all born genetically predisposed to one thing or another, and whether someone someday comes up with some type of proof that there is a genetic link to homosexuality or not, the truth is, I once was gay, and today I'm not. If it was genetic, I've overcome my genetics.
Someone would say, look, these kind of conferences, they may be all fine for people who are against homosexuality, but should homosexuals fear that they're going to be forced to change their lifestyle against their will?
You know, absolutely not. Anyone who thinks that Exodus or Focus on the Family or anyone else can force someone to change is denying the fact that we live in a free country. The truth is, there's room for all sorts of views and all sorts of opinions on the issues concerning homosexuality, and ours is not a new opinion. The truth is that people have been overcoming homosexuality for thousands of years. It's documented. And the fact is that people have a right to self-determination. If someone wants to live their life as a gay man or a lesbian woman, that is absolutely their prerogative. And we live in a free and tolerant society where they can choose to do that. Just as we live in a free and tolerant society and can choose to overcome homosexuality, there's room enough for all of us in this debate.
How do you respond to someone who says, look, the homosexual lifestyle is no different in any respect except for the gender of one's partner than the heterosexual lifestyle?
You know, I lived in the homosexual lifestyle. I was involved in it for many, many years and have witnessed firsthand the vast differences between homosexuality and heterosexuality, and there are numerous differences. I think that there are wonderful people who are involved in homosexuality, but the truth is there is no equivalent, never has been, never will be, to heterosexual relationships. The stability that comes from long-term monogamous heterosexual marriages is not equaled in any sense in homosexuality.
The picture that is portrayed for us of late in the popular media of the homosexual lifestyle is that of, and it may be, I don't know if it's accurate or not, of people who are happy, well-adjusted, large groups of friends, and pretty much just living normal, happy lives, maybe a little bit better income than the average person, and sometimes, especially on television, comic relief.
Yeah, I don't think we can look at sitcoms like Will and Grace and determine that that's what homosexuality is all about. Certainly, you know, there is some truth to the sitcoms out there. I think, by and large, we can look at movies like Brokeback Mountain and come away with a more accurate portrayal and description of what homosexuality truly is. You know, it's a heartbreaking, devastating lifestyle that affects more than just the people who are involved in it. The fact is, lifelong, loving, and committed homosexual relationships aren't possible. And I think we see that on Will and Grace, but it's more accurately portrayed in movies like Brokeback Mountain. So that really is what homosexuality is all about. There are wonderful people who are involved in homosexuality. There may be people who are happily involved in homosexuality, but it isn't the kind of lifestyle that brings life over the course of someone's lifetime.
One of the objections raised in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch piece, upcoming conference on helping gays recover draws criticism, comes from Julie Brueggemann, director of a gay rights group called Promo here in St. Louis. And she says that the whole theme of this conference runs counter to mainstream medical opinion.
I disagree. There is so much evidence out there that homosexuality is how we describe it, that it is developmental, that it is something that can be overcome, that's something that brings great trauma to people who are involved in it. It's not to say that people can't be involved in it if that's what they choose, but the fact is we are people who come from the standpoint that we once were gay and now we're not, and we are simply proclaiming that alternative for those who are interested in it.
Another one of her charges is that the message of such conferences is based on intolerance and, she says, miseducation. What does she mean here, and how do you respond?
You know, I think that people misunderstand someone having a different opinion as intolerance. The fact is we live in a very tolerant society, and those of us who proclaim that homosexuality is changeable and it's not God's best for creation, we're not the minority. We're the majority. In fact, we can look at the last election. We can look at popular polls. We can look at all sorts of statistics that point to the fact that mainstream America believes that homosexuality is something that isn't what God intended, that isn't something that people should be involved in. Certainly we should be tolerant of other views. Certainly we should be kind to our neighbor regardless of how they choose to live their life. But the truth is, what the message we're coming from, the message that we proclaim, is one that the majority of Americans agree with.
We're talking with Alan Chambers, president of Exodus International, based in Orlando, Florida, about the controversy surrounding an upcoming gay recovery conference here in St. Louis. Our call-in numbers, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Alan, some would say, look, to say that homosexuality is wrong, and then to say that I'm wrong is to say that there's something wrong with me, and to attack who I am, this issue of sexual orientation being so very personal. They say that is the definition of intolerance, to tell me that what I am doing, how I'm living, and who I love is wrong.
You know, I think that people often who are involved in homosexuality, there's a great disconnect between talking about the issue of homosexuality and talking about people. Certainly, we're not telling people that they are bad, that they're horrible, that anything like that. We come from the belief that homosexuality is a sin, like so many other sins, and that people can overcome it if that's what they choose. This message isn't to hurt people. It's not to offend people. It's simply stating what we believe to be the truth, and certainly what we lived out as the truth in our lives. We're proclaiming that to people who are interested in hearing it, bringing new information to the debate on homosexuality, new information on genetics, new information on other educational interests related to this topic. And that's really what the message of Focus on the Family, Exodus International, and certainly this Level One Out conference are all about. We're not out to hurt people. We're out to inform those who are interested in hearing the truth and the whole truth concerning the issue of homosexuality.
Cited in the story, Alan, is the opinion expressed of late by the American Psychiatric Association and the American Medical Association. The Psychiatric Association's policy, which is almost identical to that of the Medical Association, says, and I quote, that it opposes any psychiatric treatment such as reparative or conversion therapy, which is based upon the assumption that homosexuality per se is a mental disorder, or based upon the assumption that the patient should change his or her homosexual orientation.
You know, the APA has a statement that they value a client's right to self-determination. And that's what we uphold as the way that the APA should approach this issue. If someone wants to change, that's their prerogative. You know, the APA, a number of years ago, came out with that statement. The AMA also came out with the statement condemning reparative therapy, but it flies in the face of their own mission that it's a client's right to self-determine how they choose to live their life and govern their life. And the other thing is, you know, those organizations are made up of thousands of members, yet the organization the statements that are made that you just read were derived by a handful of people that really don't speak for the opinion of everyone within the AMA or the APA. And you know, that was a controversy that came out when those statements were made, that so many of the members, 74%, I believe, in the American Medical Association, didn't agree with the statement that reparative therapy was harmful. The majority of physicians, the majority of psychologists, absolutely back up the claim that people can change if they are highly motivated to do so. And that's apart from a faith-based or a religious conviction.
I have heard, and perhaps you can kind of fill in the details or correct me if I'm wrong, Alan, that the American Psychiatric Association, in its standards, was not always of the opinion that homosexuality is a normal lifestyle parallel to that of heterosexuality, was not always of the opinion that it could not be treated in any way.
Right. You know, prior to 1973, when homosexuality was taken out of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, they believed that homosexuality was a disorder. I'm not a clinician, so I don't want to say whether I believe that homosexuality is a disorder or not. Certainly not something that's normal. It's not what's typical for behavior. It's a deviation of sexuality. But a small group of political activists broke into the meeting in 1973 and forced the APA to reconsider the issue of homosexuality. It wasn't a reconsideration that was taken on the basis of fact or on the basis of science. It was done as a political measure. It was done as a way to appease a group of people who were hostile and who were angry. That's how we've seen homosexuality normalized in our society over the last 35 years or so, is that when political pressure was applied, when public pressure was applied, people have changed their story. That's not based on fact. It's not based on science. The information that we bring forth is based on fact. It's based on research. It's based on scientific study. And so that's what we hope to bring to the debate in St. Louis in February.
Would you just briefly outline the dangers, first to the individual involved in the homosexual lifestyle, the most common dangers, and then the broader dangers to society, to family, to children, et cetera, from the homosexual lifestyle?
You know, homosexuality, like any other type of unrestrained sexuality, heterosexuality, certainly we can look in our society today and see all sorts of deviations of what is the norm, a lifelong, loving, committed, heterosexual, monogamous marriage. And, you know, anything outside of that is dangerous. It's dangerous for our hearts. It's dangerous for our children. It's dangerous for our society because it promotes something that's not life-producing. It's not life-giving. It's something that takes away. Certainly, we can look at all sorts of the diseases that come from unrestrained sexuality and point to those as dangerous for our society. But I think emotionally, that's something that we don't often see or talk about in society. And certainly, we don't talk enough about what's good about sexuality, why God intended it to be simply between a man and a woman for a lifetime. Those are things that I believe that we need to talk a whole lot more about in our culture and point to the reasons why, because children are at risk when we promote or tolerate anything outside of lifelong, loving, committed, heterosexual, monogamous marriage. Children fare better in marriages. Children need a mom and a dad. Those are the reasons why we cite for homosexuality not being the best for our culture and our creation.
And how would you respond, Alan, to someone who would say, well, look, you can do what you want to, but folks like you who were once homosexual and now say that they're not are simply living in denial?
You know, the fact is, I don't have to prove to anyone that my life is real or not. I lived as a gay man, and today I'm not. I live with my wife. I have two children. There is no reason why I would promote that. I don't get paid a lot of money to do what I do. I don't have any other reason but the simple fact that I was once one way, and today I am a life that has been changed. And that's something that I love talking about. And I have no other alternative, no other reason to talk about it than the fact that it's simply the truth.
Tell us about the upcoming conference that is kind of the subject of the controversy, this conference on gay recovery.
Well, you know, and I'm gonna hit the issue of recovery. We're people who have overcome homosexuality. We're not the message of the conference most isn't anything more than educating people on the roots of homosexuality, the roots of male homosexuality, the roots of female homosexuality. Hope for those who are involved in homosexuality, hope for parents who have children involved in homosexuality. And really the thrust of the conference is talking to the church about how to lovingly reach out to those in their community. We're coming to St. Louis with a message of love, with a message of compassion. The people who leave the conference, the 1,200 men and women who leave the conference that we bring to St. Louis are going to leave with more of a desire to reach out in love than anything else. That's really the focus of what Love One Out's coming to St. Louis to do. It's the best one-day informational conference on homosexuality that there is.
Do you expect demonstrations or protests?
Absolutely. Wherever we go, we are met with protesters. We're met with demonstrators, sometimes peaceful, sometimes not. And, you know, oftentimes it's a great way to open up a dialogue in a city. We've gone into some cities where we've been able to talk across the table with the gay community. It's opened up a wonderful dialogue. We've left with churches promising that they're going to dialogue with the gay community. So hopefully that's what we'll find when we come to St. Louis.
Finally, one of my concerns about this, and with only about 30 seconds to respond, Alan, one of my concerns about this is that the more the advocates for the homosexual lifestyle, the longer they speak, the more they argue against normalcy, the more they argue against the fact that there is anything such as normal in order to incorporate into that definition how they live. Do you share that concern?
Yeah, you know, I think the more time that goes on and the more promotion there is of homosexuality, it really, there's a long coattail of people riding on that, where I think people are trying to bring down marriage. They're trying to bring down any type of restraint in the issue of sexuality at all. And, you know, that's my fear, that we're living in a time where people will continue to erode away what is normal in relationship to sexuality, which in the end only ends up hurting the next generation.
Exodus-international.org is the website address for Exodus International. Exodus-international.org. Alan Chambers is president of Exodus International, based in Orlando, Florida. Alan, thank you for being our guest.
Hey, thanks for having me, Todd.
When we come back from this break, we've got a conversation ahead about Charles Darwin. Yesterday, I believe, yes, it was yesterday, Charles Darwin would have been 197 years old. People were celebrating all over the place. Some churches even had Darwin Sundays, believe it or not. And I sound kind of cruel saying this, but I guess Charles Darwin was not among the fittest, seeing that he did not survive to his 197. We'll be right back.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Who was the Old Testament prophet Ezekiel? What were his times like? What were the circumstances in which he preached? Who was his audience? What is Ezekiel's message for us today? The Concordia Commentary on the Book of Ezekiel, the first 20 chapters, is our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February. You can find information about this book at our website, issuesetc.org, or you can visit one of two locations where Concordia Publishing House has bookstores in the St. Louis area, one at 3558 South Jefferson in the city, the other on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. Just follow the signs to the CPH bookstore and find the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February, the Concordia Commentary on Ezekiel. The book is $42.99. Remember those addresses, 3558 South Jefferson in the city or on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton.
A disturbing tradition happens all too often in the Eastern European country of Bulgaria. This Global Minute lets you know about kidnapped brides. A teenage girl who gets kidnapped from a boy in another city is a common occurrence. She's often kidnapped and raped, and it's counted as marriage. Unfortunately, she loses esteem within the culture, and her parents often bring her quietly back home. If she doesn't stay with the first boy, then she's given to someone else in order to protect the family name. But what the girl wants is totally irrelevant. The pride of the family is considered more important than the girl's future. The story was shared by missionaries with WEC International serving in Bulgaria. Pray they'll have wisdom on dealing with this tough issue. Pray they'll be able to clearly present Christ, and hearts will be changed. Your prayers are needed around the world to support missionary activities. Find out more on the website missionvisionnetwork.org. missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. In anticipation of Valentine's Day tomorrow, and in remembrance of Abraham Lincoln's birthday yesterday, Lincoln wrote a marriage proposal to Mary Owens on May 7, 1837. Lincoln's proposal included lines like these: "This thing of living in Springfield is rather a dull business, after all. I'm afraid you would not be satisfied. You would have to be poor, without the means of hiding your poverty. Do you believe you could bear that patiently?" She turned him down. 18 months later, Lincoln became engaged to Mary Todd, who was described as the very creature of excitement, and a woman who could make a bishop forget his prayers. They married November 4, 1842, but a week later Lincoln wrote to a friend, "Nothing new here, except my marrying, which to me is a matter of profound wonder." Thanks to Doris Kearns Goodwin for those quotations. She also shares Stephen Vincent Benet's description of Lincoln's problem. "When the genius of the water moves, and that's the woman's genius, I'm at sea in every sense and meaning of the word, with nothing but old patience for my chart, and patience doesn't always please a woman. Husbands, love your wives. A bishop should not forget his prayers, and neither should husbands and wives who are in love."
Wake up with inspiration, information, and sing along in the morning with AM 850 KFUO. Hi, this is Paul Clayton with a Christian alternative to Morning Drive Radio. Along with the music, we've got a number of great guests who help you start your day with an encouraging smile on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. Charles Darwin is much in the news. You know, he's been gone for a long time. He would have been almost 200 years old, 197 years since Darwin was born. People were celebrating all over the place. We're going to talk a bit about the numerous events that were held yesterday in honor of Charles Darwin's birth. And then in the second hour of the program, a bit of a sermon review. What are we going to be doing? Oh, we're going to be reviewing D. James Kennedy's latest on Abraham Lincoln and whether or not he was a Christian from Coral Ridge. Dr. Uwe Simonetto joins us after that hour-long sermon review. We'll be talking about the scientist as a godly vocation. Some people don't believe that's even possible. Uwe says, sure it is. And we'll talk about intelligent design with Uwe there as well. Wesley Smith will join us in the last half hour of the program. Missouri Senator Jim Talent has, well, okay, let's say clarified his position on stem cell research. Has he backed down from his support for a total ban on human cloning? He's taken his name off of a significant bill that would ban all human cloning. What does it mean? Wesley will explain in the last half hour of the program. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Terry Mortensen is our guest. He's a speaker, a writer, and researcher for Answers in Genesis, based in Petersburg, Kentucky. Dr. Mortensen, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Good to be with you, Todd.
What's everybody celebrating yesterday with the 197th birthday of Charles Darwin?
Well, a professor, or actually an administrator at the university in Wisconsin, some time ago, drafted a letter to try to get clergy to sign on, saying that they basically see no problem with evolution and there's no conflict between religion evolution. He's got over 10,000 signatures, and he got a number of pastors in churches, over 400, to agree to have Evolution Sunday in their churches this past weekend to declare to their congregations that there's no conflict between religion and evolution.
Why are the advocates of evolution, of macroevolution, up on their hind legs so much lately about intelligent design?
Well, I think they're getting challenges from both the intelligent design movement and the last 40 years of a growing movement of young earth creationists. And we just keep hammering away at their arguments, and they only have one resort, really, and that's to use their political power within the scientific establishment and the educational establishment to try to silence dissent.
What did Charles Darwin, in his famous research, what did he actually demonstrate? Is it more or less than what the advocates of macroevolution say he demonstrated?
All that he demonstrated is that creatures within a certain kind produce variety within that kind. Finches change into finches. Their beak sizes change, but they're finches from beginning to end. He never really demonstrated where the first living thing came from or where different kinds of creatures come from. He described how variety develops, at least partially, but he never presented the evidence that really defended the molecule to molecular biologist change that he envisioned.
So what did he actually assert? I mean, beyond what he demonstrated, what his research demonstrated, what did Charles Darwin assert by the end of his long career?
Well, basically, Darwin was applying the principles that he had learned from his friend Charles Lyell in geology. And Lyell had really been the key person to cement the idea in geology that the rocks of the earth were developed over millions and millions of years of slow, gradual geological change. And Darwin took the first volume of Lyell's book with him on his famous voyage on the HMS Beagle in 1831, and he just applied that principle of slow, gradual geological change to biology and said, if we have enough time, we can take these little changes of finch beaks and we can explain how we got birds from non-birds and how we got all the different kinds of plants and animals from the first living little tiny microscopic creature.
So it is true that Darwin actually did propose evolution from a single cell to life in all of its diversity and plurality as we know it?
Yeah, that's what he was asserting. But the evidence that he always provided was only of change within what creationists would call the original created kinds.
All right. Explain that phrase that you just used, the original created kinds, and then the distinction between change within a species and what Darwin said.
Well, of course, species was a categorization of living things. It was developed by the great Swedish taxonomist Linnaeus. So it wasn't the word that was used in the Bible. The Bible was, the Old Testament was written in Hebrew, and the word there is a word min, M-I-N in English. And it's used 10 times in Genesis 1. God created the plants on day 3, and it says 3 times there that God created the plants according to their kind. And then we see the same word on day 5 when God creates the sea creatures and the birds, and on day 6 when he creates the land animals, that God created these creatures after their kind. So he created different kinds of plants, different kinds of sea creatures, different kinds of birds and land animals to reproduce after their kind, but the implication is clear that they would not change from one kind into a different kind. Now, creationists today are trying to identify biologically what were the boundaries of the original created kinds, and we're not absolutely sure there. We've got a lot more research to do, but it's almost certainly not at the level of what we call today species. It's in many cases, it may be at the level of genus or even at family. So to say that we have a new species isn't necessarily saying that anything is substantially different. You can have different species of dogs, but they're all within the dog kind that includes wolf and jackal and dingo and domestic dogs.
Give us a brief biography, if you would, of Darwin.
Well, Darwin was born in 1809 in Shrewsbury, England. His father was a medical doctor, and that led to Darwin going to the University of Edinburgh to study medicine, but he quickly realized this wasn't really his cup of tea, so to speak, and he transferred to Cambridge University in 1828 to study theology, but that wasn't a fit for him either because he wasn't a true believer. And while he was at Cambridge, he came under the influence of two scientists, one a biologist by the name of Henslow and another geologist by the name of Sedgwick. And Adam Sedgwick really tutored Darwin in geology and really fused into his mind the idea of millions of years, that Earth history was much older than the Bible says. And then Henslow was the one who got him assigned to the HMS Beagle with as the traveling assistant and naturalist with Captain Robert Fitzroy. And then he came back after that five-year voyage from 1831 to 36, where he traveled down all the way around South America and then over to Australia. And he published a book in 1840 on the zoology that he observed from his trip. And then those ideas of evolution were percolating in his mind, which were the result of several influences. And he published his book in 1859 that rocked the world, and that went through several editions. And then he published a book on the descent of man, arguing that we evolved from ape-like creatures, and he died in 1882.
How were Darwin's ideas, especially those in Origin of the Species in 1859, how were they first received?
Well, the church leaders, many of the church leaders quickly accepted his idea, but the fiercest opposition was actually from scientists, including Adam Sedgwick, who had taught Darwin geology at Oxford. He was a professing Christian, and Sedgwick was not happy with the idea of evolution.
Did Darwin ever express himself on his opinion of what we would call today young Earth creationism? I think you and I probably commonly hold the position of a literal six-day creation according to Genesis. Did he ever express his opinion on that idea?
I'm not sure that he did. By the time he got to Cambridge and studied under Sedgwick, the young Earth view was coming under severe attack, and most of the leading geologists, including Adam Sedgwick, had rejected the biblical chronology and rejected the flood as having really anything to do with the geological record. And so Darwin was, I'm sure he was aware of the scriptural geologists. These were men in the early 1800s who were defending the young Earth view. In fact, Captain Fitzroy, who was on that famous voyage with him for 5 years, he was a young Earth creationist, and in 1839, after they both got back from that trip, he published a book about his own journals from the Beagle trip, and he clearly indicated that he was a young Earth creationist, and he was troubled by the old Earth views that were being presented in the 1830s. So Darwin was aware of it, but I'm not a Darwin scholar, but I'm not aware that he ever directly spoke to that issue, because by the time he was developing his ideas, the scientific community was almost unanimous in their view of millions of years.
You mentioned in passing just a moment ago that the church leaders at the time of Darwin's publishing his big work, Origin of Species, in 1859, were pretty happy to receive these ideas. How is that?
Well, the big problem, Todd, was that in the first 50 years of the 19th century, the 19th century, those first 50 years of the 1800s, The church quickly compromised on Noah's flood and on the biblical chronology and a literal six-day creation. And that's one of the topic that I studied in my PhD, in fact, in the book The Great Turning Point, which people can get on our website at www.answersingenesis.org. The Great Turning Point discusses how the church compromised and discusses the men who were trying to defend the truth of Genesis. And so by the time Darwin's theory had come along in 1859, most of the church, almost 100% of the church, had compromised the chronology of Genesis. They had rejected the literal days. They had rejected the time frame that Genesis gives for the age of the earth. They had rejected the flood, and so they really weren't prepared to be able to defend against Darwin's theory.
What kind of relationship was that compromise, did that compromise have with today, a position that is held by people who, at least in my opinion, kind of want to have it both ways, the old earth creationists, the person who would say, well, yes, we are talking about long scales of time here,
mm-hmm.
but God is still behind it in some way, and that the account of Genesis 1 and 2 really is a bare outline, not to be taken literally, but just telling us God's there in the background moving this thing along. But other than that, it really happened pretty much the way that the evolutionists said it happened.
Well, that kind of idea was really unheard of for the first 18 centuries of the church. The almost universal belief of Christian leaders and Bible expositors and commentators was that God created in 6 days about 6,000 years ago, and that the flood was global and catastrophic. So it was in the early 1800s that the church, under the influence of the claims of unbelieving geologists, they compromised with this idea of millions of years. And so for the last 200 years, we've just had generation after generation of Bible scholars that have been trained in seminary and Bible school to not believe Genesis. Many of them don't believe Darwin's theory of origins because they don't like the idea that man evolved from some ape-like creature. But they've accepted the geological theory of millions of years and the age of dinosaurs and the Big Bang theory for the origin of the universe and that kind of thing. And it's a result of 200 years of compromise. And I could cite all kinds of very famous godly men, including people like Charles Spurgeon, who were compromised on the issue of the age of the earth. And that led many others to do the same.
We're talking with Dr. Terry Mortensen, a speaker, writer, and researcher for Answers in Genesis based in Petersburg, Kentucky, about Charles Darwin. Numerous events were held yesterday in honor of the 197th anniversary of Darwin's birth. Our call-in numbers, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Dr. Mortensen, still on the subject of the old earth creationist, I've gone round and round with listeners on this. We've had open lines where I've asked, you know, I'm very upfront, I believe in a literal six-day creation. I'm a young earth creationist, and I just ask people, do you believe this? Do you think it's important? And the listeners will say, well, come on, I mean, it's not really that important. Some of them will say it is, some of them won't. I'll get email, Dr. Mortensen, from people who will say, look, I can look at the account, the Genesis account, and I can read there, without any conflict, the evolution of the animal kingdom, and then a special creation of man at some point late in that cycle. Does that fit in a fair reading of Genesis?
I don't think it does. And I think a person who says that has not read carefully the details in Genesis 1, or they don't know the order of events according to the evolutionary theory. Because just for starters, the Bible has the earth in existence on day one, and the sun, moon, and stars not in existence until day four. And according to the evolutionary theory of the cosmos, the sun came into existence and most of the stars and galaxies came into existence before the earth. So you have a huge contradiction in order. The Bible has land plants created on day three and fish and birds created on day five. That's the exact opposite order of evolutionary history. And in evolutionary history, the fish came into existence hundreds of millions of years before the first birds, whereas the Bible has them on the same day before land animals, including reptiles. The evolutionists have the reptiles evolving into birds. So you can only harmonize evolution with what Genesis says if you don't pay attention to any of the details.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Let's go to the phones. We'll talk first with Nick, who calls from St. Louis. Hi, Nick.
Hi, gentlemen. How are you?
Very well.
Yeah, I just had a thought in regard to pointing to centuries of Bible expositors that they have interpreted the Genesis account in the literal 6 days. It does seem as though, for instance, the idea that this, a lot of the same Bible expositors interpreted the Genesis account to point to, for instance, the a geocentric view of the Earth. And then, of course, later it seems due to good scientific investigation and discovery, we come to find that the Earth is not essentially the center of the universe. And this kind of scientific investigation then calls for let's look at, did we properly interpret the text? So it does seem reason is God-given. So if we make the argument, look, there's good scientific investigation, and there are cases where we got it wrong, even several centuries of getting it wrong. So if it turns out there would be good Darwinian arguments, not saying there are at this point, but if there are, then doesn't seem like there's precedent to go back in and look at maybe our interpretation.
All right. It's a good question, Nick. Thank you very much. Two questions there, really. First of all, if they were wrong on a geocentric universe, couldn't they be wrong on other things if there's scientific evidence to suggest that they may be? And attendant to that, does the text of Genesis anywhere discuss the Earth's geographical location in the universe or assert a geocentric universe?
Okay, well, let's take the second question first. Genesis 1 doesn't say anything about the place of the Earth in the physical universe. And in fact, that passage was never used by anyone, to my knowledge. It was usually references in the Psalms, which are a place where we find a lot of symbolic literature, a lot of symbolic language. And so we've got to be careful. We don't interpret the Psalms literally everywhere. For example, when it says that the Lord is my rock and my fortress, we don't say, well, God is a big stone or a building. That's figurative language. But when we deal with Genesis 1, we're dealing with historical narrative, and there's all kinds of indications that this is not poetry, this is not allegory or myth, this is historical narrative. And furthermore, the statements about the Earth's position are really passing statements. There's not a sustained description or argument, whereas in Genesis 1, you have just an enormous amount of information given, and it's affirmed as literal history by all of the New Testament writers who refer to those early chapters of Genesis and Jesus himself. So there's a lot of supporting evidence in the New Testament that we should interpret that as literal history.
Matt calls from Richmond Heights. Matt, welcome.
Thank you. I'm curious what your best arguments are for short age of the Earth, besides, of course, morning and evening and the early passages there in Yom being a regular 24-hour day. Given that, what other biblical supports would you use to say that, that the Earth is young?
All right. Thank you very much, Matt.
Okay. An additional argument for the days being literal in Genesis 1, besides the common refrain of there was evening and morning one day, evening and morning a second day, is Exodus 20, verse 11, the fourth commandment. God tells the children of Israel to work 6 days and rest on the seventh, and he gives the reason for In 6 days, I created the heavens, the earth, the sea, and all that is in them. So God created everything in 6 days, and he uses the same Hebrew word, day, as he does in the first part of the commandment. As far as how long ago those 6 days were, we have the genealogies in Genesis 5 and 11. Genesis 5 takes us from Adam to Noah, and Genesis 11 takes us from Noah to Abraham, and we're told how old each patriarch was when the next son of importance was born, and then how long the patriarchs lived before they died. And so we get a, if there are no missing names in those genealogies, and there are lots of good biblical reasons for believing that there are no missing names, then we have roughly 4,000 years from Adam to Abraham, and then there's lots of chronological information scattered throughout the Old and New Testament that we can pinpoint Abraham at about 2,000 B.C., so that puts the age of the earth at approximately 6,000 years.
Dr. Mortensen, we've got a number of people who'd like to post questions and comments with you here, and our time is short. Would you be willing to stay with us for a few minutes on the other side of this break?
Sure.
All right, let's take one more phone call here and perhaps get Dr. Mortensen's response on the other side of the break. Charles calls from Chesterfield. Charles, our time is short. Welcome.
Yes, Todd, thank you. I'd like you to pass on your my regards to the your guest, I don't remember his name, but for his work. My question is basically to you. I don't know the sources, and I can't be definitive on them, but I've read and heard in a couple resources about Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. I'm not certain of the colleges. I think of the Concordia colleges.
Mm-hmm.
Not certain about the seminaries. Getting into the area of compromise on the creationist scenario. And I wonder if you'd comment on that, please.
That's a very good question. Thank you very much. Well, as briefly as I can in the minute left to us, and we will take more of your questions and your comments on the other side of this break for Dr. Terry Mortensen, as we talk about Charles Darwin on this day after the anniversary of his 197th birthday. Well, there certainly has been some controversy in about the last 3 or 4 years in the Lutheran Church Missouri Center with regard to one of our higher education institutions where there had been compromise made on the teaching of a six-day creation. It is the official position adopted by the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod that the literal six-day creation reading of Genesis chapters 1 and 2 is true and is our position. There are probably a lot who will want to argue with that, but that is the holdings of our church. When we come back from this break, we'll continue our conversation for a few minutes on Charles Darwin with Dr. Terry Mortensen, and then we'll do Open Lines, a sermon review of D. James Kennedy's latest.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod.